Movie mania grips this country with the force of King Kong's fist. Our abiding love for the movie ensures that everybody is a critic. Witness the crowd coming out of any movie theater, be it art house or multiplex, and you can listen in to each breathless review. But professional critics sneaking silently in and out of the dark, notebook in hand, well, they're a difficult bunch. They're hailed as arbiters of taste and vilified as snobs. They can put a picture into historical or social context or trash it with a few quick quips. For the better part of a century now, they've fueled feuds, triggered debates, and made us think. Novelist and poet Philip Lopate is out with a new compendium called American Movie Critics, an anthology from the silence till now, a love letter to a dynamic literary art form. Later in the program, we'll move from Hollywood to Paris, where student protests against labor laws continue. But first, to the movies, and we want your critique. Do movie reviews influence what you see and the way you see it? Do you read them before or after the movie? What critics do you love or hate, and why? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Editor Philip Lopate, an occasional film critic himself, is with us today. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Very glad to be here.
And I have to say, you begin the book, and I did a double take, with poet Vachel Lindsay, who I remember as Mumbo Jumbo, God of the Congo, and all of the
That's
other gods
right.
of the Congo. Uh-huh. I didn't realize he was a movie critic.
Not only Vachel Lindsay, but Carl Sandburg were both practicing film critics, and Robert E. Sherwood, the dramatist, was also a practicing film critic. At the beginning, you know, amateurs got into it. There was no such thing as a professional film criticism.
And interesting that in these very first reviews by Vachel Lindsay, he seems to nail the concept of the action movie right down. He does a rather a brilliant comparison of stage and film versions of The Three Musketeers and comes to a conclusion as to why the movie version is so much better.
He really loved movies, and at that time, movies were denigrated one step above the Nickelodeon, and Lindsay wanted to argue that they were an art form, or potentially an art form.
Yes, and you come to the end of his first review, which is, having read thus far, why not close the book and go round the corner to the photoplay theater, give the preference to the cheapest one?
Yes. Film critics have always been torn between populist and elitist impulses. Most film critics love movies, period, and can easily be seduced by what Pauline Kael called trash. On the other hand, they've got to keep an eye out for the real breakthroughs and achievements, and so they kind of operate on two tiers.
Carl Sandburg, you mentioned, he too defends the motion picture or photoplay, as it was called at the time, as a as an art form. He writes about Robert Flaherty's famous documentary, sort of documentary, Nanook of the North.
Yes.
A novel and a poem and a biography and an epic, he says, it takes the curse off motion pictures to the extent that those who anathematize the movies without making an exception of Nanook of the North thereby display merely their own pathetic ignorance of one picture product that stands compared with things of highest excellence produced by the other arts.
Wow. Yeah, he got pretty lyrical and enthusiastic, and some of his film reviews read like prose poems.
He's an extraordinary. At the time, you capsulize all the other things that he was doing at this particular time, finishing his biography of Lincoln,
That's
publishing
right.
a couple of books, and an analysis of American folk music.
Yes, what he would do is he would watch films on Saturday or Sunday, and then he would go to his house and type out the criticism, and he'd do the whole thing in a day or two. And then he'd go back to Mr. Lincoln.
And go back to Mr. Lincoln, another lasting piece of work. When did film criticism become a profession?
Well, that's a funny question. I mean, I think there have always been film reviewers in newspapers and magazines, but they tended to be moved in for a while and then moved out, like in the Army, where if you're a painter, you're put on KP duty, and if you're
right.
if you're a good cook, you're sent to paint the barn. I think the first really major American movie critic was Otis Ferguson, who wrote for The New Republic. And magazines like The Nation and The New Republic encouraged a lot of film criticism, and they didn't have movie ads from the theaters, so the critics were free to speak their minds.
As opposed to the big newspapers or a trade publication like Variety.
Yes, there's always a lot of pressure put by the industry on the film critic, and of course the good ones resist it. And then ones like Otis Ferguson or James Agee didn't have to worry about it too much because they were writing for small publications, although Agee did switch to Time after he wrote for The Nation at first.
Is that still the case, do you think?
I think that any good film critic worth his salt is going to be able to resist the pressures. Famous example, Kenneth Turan panned Titanic, and after a few negative appreciations of that movie, James Cameron, the director, called for his head, or rather said that they should fire him because he wasn't reflecting the taste of the public. And it raised an interesting question. Should a film critic necessarily raise the taste of the, reflect the taste of the public? And Turan said, well, you know, if I'm a restaurant critic and a couple is looking for that extra special cuisine experience, I'm not going to recommend that they go to McDonald's just because everybody goes there. So you don't have to be a mirror of the public. You have to know your own mind, and I do think you have to be fair-minded, let's say.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. We're talking about film criticism and film critics with Philip Lopate. And let's talk with Noah. Noah's calling us from San Francisco.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
So my mom was a film critic here in the Bay Area. I'm calling from San Francisco. And my wife and I, we don't have TV or cable or anything, but we watch at least a movie a night.
That's
and
great.
We fastidiously ignore any sort of film critique, even though we get films from Netflix.
Yes.
I'll watch the trailer. That's about it.
And this because of the experience with your mom?
It's got a little bit to do with it.
Your mom was who?
Sharon Sussman. She worked for a small paper in Mill Valley. And just, I mean, the point only being that even though it runs in the family, I still ignore it. It just, it's too much about, you know, the popular media, which I'm totally distrustful of.
I've got to say, I think it's really more about writing. I edited a big anthology before this one called The Art of the Personal Essay, and I'm in love with essays and I'm in love with movies. And so for me, I go to read movie critics the same way I go to read Edmund Wilson on the literature of the past. That is, I go for the pleasures of prose.
Okay. Yeah, I you know, I will read a review, but only after I've seen the movie.
But what about film criticism of old movies that aren't in the theaters now? That you should be able to face that without too much trouble.
Sure. If I've seen the film, I will read it. That's true. And in fact, just to enjoy the writing, as you're saying.
Noah, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And it's interesting, Philip Lopate, in your introduction, you argue that film criticism is essentially a literary form.
Yeah, it's interesting because a film critic has to be a good visual describer because you have to convey something of the imagery. But it is a form practiced by writers. And what's going to make or break a piece of film criticism, in my opinion, is the sparkle of the style, the wit, the compression, the insight, intelligence. So I think what I try to do in this book, which is really unique, I think it's the only comprehensive book that puts together all of the best of American film criticism, is to argue that it is a form of American writing and a pleasure in its own right.
Let's get Alan on the line. Alan's calling from Union, Kentucky.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really fascinated by this topic today, and I might add to your guests that I, too, love essays and love movies and have, from time to time in my life, written essays on film. And I agree that it's a literary form, especially the good ones. Unfortunately, that the opportunity is not there for most critics who review for daily papers because of space limitations and editorial stances and so on. But the real reason for my call is that I've already heard Pauline Kael's name a few times on the program today. And Pauline Kael is generally regarded as the queen goddess of film criticism, if not just the god of film criticism. And I sort of thought that for the longest time because I grew up on Pauline Kael. I discovered her reviews in the early 70s when I was in my early teens, and I read her religiously for many years and used to sort of hang on her every word.
Yes.
But in looking over her reviews some years later when I was a bit older, because I have all of her books, I really found that I didn't care for a lot of her work overall simply because of the stance she took, which is basically not really looking at a movie on its own merits, but it's just sort of liking what she liked, which to some people that's a legitimate approach, you know, well, it's just one person's taste. And I feel that film criticism really has to go above one person's taste because you may not, say, like Westerns or musicals or whatever, but you have to acknowledge that there are good films in those particular genres. And although a certain subject matter or what a film is aspiring to or the kind of film it is may not appeal to you personally, I think that a really good critic has to rise above that, has to allow for the fact that there are good kinds of films that may not appeal to you personally. And I think that this was the big flaw in Kael's body of work.
Well, Kael was very partisan. I think she was a great film critic, but I'm a polytheist. I worship at the shrine of Manny Farber, Andrew Saris, Otis Ferguson, James Agee, Parker Tyler, and Kael. I think that and Robert Washaw, many others. I think that that all film critics have their limitations and their strong points. For instance, Kael was very good on comedy between the sexes, and very weak on Westerns. She wrote a piece where she said she just didn't get it. And so I think that you have to kind of not depend on one film critic, but it's like a friendship, you know. Stanley Cavell said that he considered a good film critic the missing companion. So you don't have only one friend. You try to have a few friends, and they complement each other.
Alan, thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you.
We're talking today about movie critics this hour, reviewing the reviewers, if you will. Our guest is Philip Lopate. He's the editor of American Movie Critics, an anthology from The Silence Until Now. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the great American movie critics this hour, a critic critique. Philip Lopate is with us. He's the editor of a new compendium, America's Movie Critics, an anthology from The Silence Until Now. Of course, we want to hear from you. What do you use film criticism for? Who are your favorites? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And earlier, Philip Lopate mentioned Kevin Turan, Kenneth Turan. And he, of course, is the film critic for the Los Angeles Times and for NPR's Morning Edition. I just wanted to play an excerpt of a review that he did of the movie called Coyote Ugly.
Like some smelly cheese that delights epicures but gags ordinary folk, the shameless but very watchable Coyote Ugly is a bad movie for connoisseurs of the genre. The story of a small-town innocent who moves to New York to, yes, follow her dream. This combination of sentimental romance and carefully sanitized raunch is Flashdance all over again. It's a PG-13 equal opportunity date night movie. Guys get to admire women in breath-constricting clothing, while girls swoon over a fairy tale romance that looks hot and contemporary, but is about as steamy as National Velvet.
That, an excerpt from Kenneth Turan's review of Coyote Ugly. And Philip Lopate, I wonder, do you give more credence? Sometimes bad reviews are much more fun to read.
Yeah, they are. But I have to say that you have to see a critic in love to see what a critic is really made of, you know? Because sometimes a series of movies that you don't like just makes you crabby, you know? and for instance, some critics are very good at ambivalence, you know? They really get analytical when they have mixed feelings about a movie.
And at some point, you do have to make a stand or take a stand if your review is going to be helpful to the reader, don't you think?
I do. Although Manny Farber said that he thought that the final judgment or opinion was the least important function of a critic. He thought that film criticism was a kind of thinking on the page about a movie and didn't necessarily have to come to a final judgment. I like critics who make judgments in general, but maybe because I like that spine in the piece.
There's the great film critic Andrew Saris, of course, was famous for making lists, you know, the Pantheon, you know, that sort of thing. And yet there are many critics who said, that's ridiculous. How can you possibly?
Right. One thing that I love about Andrew Saris is that he's always willing to second guess himself. He didn't put Billy Wilder in his pantheon. And then years later, he said, well, I was just being intimidated by my peers, and really I made a mistake. And he would go back again and again. And of course, movies look very different to us when we see them in our 20s, our 30s, our 40s, and even older. So Saris is someone who has a dialogue with the past that never stops, whereas Pauline Kael said she never wanted to see a movie more than once. I didn't quite believe that, actually. I think she sneaked back and saw them again.
And it's one of the most greatest pleasures of this book is to go and read contemporary reviews of films that we now regard as classics that didn't get such good reviews when they first came out.
Exactly. Otis Ferguson had his doubts about Citizen Kane. A movie like The Graduate was definitely attacked. And very funny things about the original King Kong was said that makes you realize that, you know, they couldn't possibly be reverential towards these films when they came out because they weren't classics yet.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Kaizad, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Columbus,
Absolutely.
Ohio. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Oh, well, thank you for calling.
I have a couple of sort of comments and then a question. One, I think that we have to be careful to make the distinction between film criticism and film journalism. You know, what I call the sort of Siskel and Ebertification of film criticism, which is that, you know, the public needs two thumbs up or four stars out of five stars. Which really does a disservice to, I think, both the audience and the films. And with the sort of trend of, you know, film reviews becoming shorter and shorter due to space limitations or other constraints, you know, one doesn't really get much serious film criticism, perhaps as one used to.
Can I respond to that before we go on to the other questions?
Go ahead.
I actually tend to think there's less of a distinction than most people make between film criticism and film reviewing. I think there's good film writing and bad film writing. And I give an example. Vincent Canby, who was the daily critic of the New York Times and I think certainly one of the best daily critics that the country has ever seen, he could do in 600 to 1,000 words the soul of a movie, whereas some people go on for 30 pages and I don't quite get to the gist of it yet. So I agree with you that it's a shame that there are these space limitations, and I wish there were many more outlets and venues for sustained film criticism. But I also think that a reviewer can hit the nail on the head. You mentioned Roger Ebert. He actually has a clean prose style, and sometimes I think he's quite on the mark, and it's as much a kind of film criticism as sustained work.
Yeah, I wasn't so much criticizing Ebert for his writing as I was the sort of the two thumbs up sort of system.
I know, I agree with you. Yeah.
The quick comments. One is that I think that, you know, the film industry has figured out that reviews sometimes do matter, because I'm a film critic for certain publications myself, in addition to teaching about film. There are many films that are not released for criticism prior to, because perhaps they're afraid of the reviews that they might get and sort of sink a film before it even appears.
But usually for good reason.
Yes, absolutely. But the last thing that I want to sort of bring up, and I think that this was sort of has become apparent since the emergence of films like Fahrenheit 9/11 and sort of films that have been sort of overtly political within Hollywood, is that there has been, you know, an attack, and a legitimate attack in some cases, perhaps, from differing viewpoints. But what is the role of the film critic in sort of speaking to sort of perhaps attacks that are not necessarily legitimate upon film? So, for instance, you have a phenomenon like Brokeback Mountain, which appeared recently, and there was an attack from the right that called it part of the homosexualizing of America, or the homosexualization of America. Mm-hmm. I didn't see a lot of film critics sort of stand up to the plate and sort of call that, one, a ludicrous claim, because when we had sort of critically acclaimed film like Silence of the Lambs, we didn't accuse Hollywood of the cannibalization of America. And so where does this sort of role of the critic fit in sort of speaking to film beyond its role as entertainment, but perhaps as part of the political, cultural, socioeconomic zeitgeist.
I think Chianti sales did go up, though. But anyway.
I think all the best film critics have addressed social questions, sociological and political questions, because a film critic brings everything in his or her mind to the job, and we live in a time we can't help but respond. I think, you know, you made an interesting example about Brokeback Mountain. I think there were film critics who defended it a great deal on the basis of its politics. And sometimes when somebody says something especially stupid, like that comment about the homosexualization of America, it almost doesn't require a counterattack. My own feeling tends to be a little formalist. That is, I thought that Brokeback Mountain was a good film, but a little stiff and uncalculated. A friend of mine who is gay said, it's a morality play, but it's the right morality play. It's a good morality play, and I agree with that.
Kaizad, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your phone call. Let's talk now with Carrie. Carrie's with us from Sacramento.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
In listening to your program, I find it delightful, but I don't pay much attention to movie reviews or critics because I find that their comments portray part of their liberal political slant, and I find that offensive. And usually, if I'm looking at a review, I'll pick the review that is from a smaller community, and usually I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
If the critic does not like the movie, usually I do like the movie.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, then that sounds like liberal critics would be very helpful to you, because all you have to do is reverse their judgment and you know what to like.
Exactly. And I don't understand why. Of course, listening to your last caller, yeah, and you're right. They have to take all that they're about and write it into the review.
Mm-hmm.
But I only go to the movies for sheer entertainment, not education, not any other aspect. I don't care if it's slow or fast. I want to be entertained for my money.
And this debate over art versus entertainment, your book makes it clear. This goes back to day one of the movies.
Absolutely, right. And it's it puts film critics in an awkward position because so many movies are made obviously not with the intention to be art, but simply entertaining. And so we bring different standards to them, and we discuss them as entertainment. By the way, there are some excellent non-liberal film critics, some of whom I put in the book, like John Simon, who should be read. You know, there are lots. They've always been good. Film critics of all political stripes. But I have to say that I'm one of those snobs who gets more entertainment out of art than out of simple entertainment.
Great.
Carrie, thanks very much. Have a good time at the movies.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Robert. Robert's with us from Tucson. Robert, you're...
Hello?
You've got two things competing for your attention there. Go ahead, Robert. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that one of the important things about film criticism is that you've got to want to read it for it to have an effect.
Yes.
And I would like to compare David Denby and Anthony Lane at The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to me, Anthony Lane is just a joy to read, while David Denby is just a little... turgid.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a David Denby critic there with you.
Yeah.
There's a baby crying in the background if you can't hear it. So, let's get a comment from Philip Lope.
Well, I think they do bring different virtues and vices to the table. I think that Anthony Lane is a more pleasurable stylist and funnier than Denby, and Denby can be rather solemn at times. A kind of overly sincere. Sometimes Anthony Lane can be a little glib, like the tired businessman who says,
sometimes.
What are they trying to pull off on me? And Denby can be very good on certain moral issues, let's say, I'd rather read Denby on a documentarian like Fred Weissman than Anthony Lane, because Anthony Lane can't have too much fun with it, and so he won't know what to do with it.
Yeah, on occasion, I think Anthony Lane goes for having too much fun rather than dealing with the issues. Mm-hmm. I tend to agree with them both.
Yeah.
And enjoy reading them both, but Anthony Lane, like you say, is just fun.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Robert, take care of your business.
I will, thanks. Okay.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're talking today with Philip Lopate, the novelist and poet who's now the editor of a new book, American Movie Critics, an Anthology from the Silence Till Now. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk now with Lewis. Lewis calling us from Provo, Utah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious. I'm also an avid moviegoer. I love checking out a movie before I go see it, obviously, for a lot of different reasons. One of the maybe more recent technological advances, I guess, is the use of the Internet to review movies. These sites like IMDb, Internet Movie Database,
exactly.
For example, I like to check out both the Internet site as well as the critic site, because sometimes I recognize that the critic has to come from perhaps a more artistic point of view, whereas sometimes I'd like to find out, you know, I'm just in the mood for a good laugh. I don't care if I leave a changed individual. So I go check
yes.
out the popular reviews. I'm just curious what role the Internet is playing in changing the role of the movie critic.
I think the Internet is going to play a larger and larger role. And I think there's going to be more film criticism on the Internet, and younger people are going to go to it first. I think that the great tradition of American film criticism has obviously been in print, and a lot of stuff I read on the Internet has a kind of rushed, unprocessed quality as prose, you know, but it's tremendously important as information, and there are elegant styles starting to appear on the Internet as well.
I definitely agree. Do you feel
yeah.
like it diminishes the role of the film critic, though, when people will start turning to that before and replacing that that source instead of the written?
Well,
I guess the printed.
The film critic will always have a role, especially film critics of the past, in terms of educating oneself to the history of film. You know, I mean, we're talking as though the only thing that film critics can do is respond to the immediate moment, you know. But one of the reasons that I put out this book was that people could get pleasure in reading all this beautiful film criticism of the past. What's coming? I don't know. It could be film criticism will become largely irrelevant, in which case my volume will be a testimony to a beautiful lost art. It could be that film criticism will become more important, in which case it will spur them on to greater heights. I'm
well,
not a prophet, unfortunately.
To the bestseller list before that happens, all right?
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Lewis.
Okay, thanks.
So long. And let's try Jim. Jim with us from Kansas City.
Hi, Neil and Philip. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As a parents of three girls, my wife and I have just noticed over the last few years that some critics and reviewers, not all, but some, just don't seem to know how to review children's
that's
movies.
True.
You know,
yes.
they'll measure them with all the measures that they might go into a serious drama or an art film.
Yes.
That's and I'm wondering
point.
Why they don't, you know, take kids with them of different ages and report on, you know, say, you know, the 7-year-old was laughing out loud while the 12-year-old thought it was boring, or just a little more information on a kid level.
Yeah, some of them do. For instance, A.O. Scott of the Times often talks about his children's responses. My own film viewing these days tends to be really skewed between little art movies and movies that my 11-year-old daughter wants to see. So I've seen a lot of Lindsay Lohan and Hilary Duff movies, and I saw recently The Shaggy Dog, which I recommend. I thought it was very funny. It's the kind of movie that probably won't be treated very seriously by movie reviewers, but it actually works.
One of the great pleasures of several years ago, I had a teenage son, was getting to go with him to all the real blow-em-ups. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes, you know, they'll say, like, the plot wasn't plausible or the humor was predictable, but for, you know, 5 to 10-year-olds, that's fine, you know.
And also, it's amazing how quickly kids themselves become discerning and analytical about genres, about stale formulas and things like that. They know when the pattern is repeating itself. So they can be trusted in their own way. I think maybe there should be kid reviewers on the Internet.
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
When we come back from the break, we're going to continue our conversation with Philip Lopate about film criticism and film critics. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. talk@npr.org. After that, it's springtime in Paris. That this year it means tear gas and rubber bullets. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're talking about film critics with Philip Lopate. His new book is American Movie Critics, an Anthology from the Silence Until Now. Earlier we were talking about Pauline Kael, the great reviewer, who gave a somewhat ambiguous review to Lawrence of Arabia.
Why, if I enjoyed the movie, am I so angry about it? It's rather complicated. They attempt to do the impossible, even as Lawrence did, and they end up in compromises and simplifications and cuts. They wind up with beautiful cinematography and blood and battles, and what is sacrificed is the figure of Lawrence, too complex a hero for the spectacle form, so he becomes a series of literary flourishes.
The great Pauline Kael. Our guest Philip Lopate is with us from our bureau in New York, and it's interesting, in your introduction, Philip, you say that one of the things that film criticism is not supposed to be about is instructing movie makers as to what to do. Yet clearly, that's what a lot of critics spend their time doing.
They should be humble about their capacity to change filmmakers. In a funny way, American movie critics have influenced filmmakers a lot. People like Manny Farber and Pauline Kael and Andrew Saras, because before filmmakers were filmmakers, they were usually fans or film buffs, and they fantasized doing something that would gain the approval of these superegos, you might say. But once a filmmaker's career is launched, you know, what's going to make or break a new film is not necessarily going to be, will this critic or that critic like it? There are too many random and contingent factors. Too many things have to go right for you. And you can't be making your film for film critics' approbation.
There was that whole wave, the new wave, of French filmmakers who started out as film critics, yes. Godard and Truffaut.
And there have been some Americans also. Paul Schrader, Peter Bogdanovich, people like Jonas Mekas. Earlier on, there was... there have been different filmmakers who have strayed back and forth. Susan Sontag made a few films, Pat Lorenz. I think almost every film critic has a screenplay in his or her drawer and fantasize someday being called to Hollywood.
Yeah, everybody wants to direct.
Yeah.
Let's get another caller on the line. Barry. Barry's with us from Peach Orchard in Missouri.
Yeah, great show y'all are doing today. Always happy to hear people discussing criticism. But, you know, one thing that I wanted to mention is I think that as readers of criticism, we have an obligation to consume criticism in the same way that we consume movies. I think some of the people that call in and say, well, I'd never listen to critics or, you know, I find them offensive or whatever, they're missing out on the fact that if you listen to criticism and you read criticism and you learn which critics have, you know, particular weaknesses, biases, and strengths, then they are a very effective tool for really learning more about the medium and for, you know, obviously very few of us are going to go see all 400 films that were released in the United States this year.
Thank goodness, yes. Well, that's very true. I think that the best film critics are always pushing to get at a larger meaning, a larger context. The way earlier we heard Pauline Kael mentioning the problem of doing character within a spectacle movie. You know, they're trying to look at these questions of genre and character and politics, if you will, as well as art. So you can really learn a lot from them.
Well, and even with a good critic, someone like Pauline Kael, she can trash a movie, and if when you read her review, you know you can find the things in there that let you know, this is where I differ from this person.
Exactly.
I'm going to love
exactly.
this movie. I've got to go see this movie. You know, because the good critics give you enough information to make that decision on your own.
That's very well put. What I discovered in assembling this book was that every single film critic I would disagree with at some point, you know. But in some ways, film critics are provocateurs, and they're trying to irritate you sometimes for your own good.
Barry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
All right.
Let's try now Andrea. Andrea is with us from Portland.
Hi. I was just calling to talk about my favorite film critic,
sure.
Which is Keith Phipps from The Onion.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I think he's amazing. I have to say I developed like a really strong relationship with critics that I love, and he's up there with Lester Bangs as far as criticism, and I think music criticism would be, you know, on par also with
yes.
being a literary art form.
Right.
I think the closest you get to him is, Philip, in the book, is Paul Rudnick, who writes as Libby Gelman-Waxner.
Yes,
a wonderful exactly. review of Dances with Wolves.
Dances with Wolves,
He describes as a boy named Sue. Here's an excerpt. Now,
Can I just read that first paragraph?
Absolutely.
This is... Paul Rudnick pretending to be Libby Gelman-Waxner. I have often wondered what would have happened if instead of having my own room with a canopy bed and a Snoopy phone in Great Neck, I had been kidnapped as a child by Indians and raised as a Sioux. Now, thanks to Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, I have my answer. In this 3-hour cinematic epic, Mary McDonnell plays a white woman who was brought up in a teepee after her pioneer family was slaughtered and scalped. As a squaw, Mary behaves just the way I would. She wears stunning suede outfits, trimmed with shells, and Ralph Lauren-style Santa Fe fringe. She does her hair in a flattering shag look instead of too severe tribal braids. And after her first husband dies, she holds out until a white movie star shows up. Mary is called Stands with a Fist because she once hit an Indian girl who gave her a hard time. In my high school yearbook, The Great Neck Senior Serenade, I was voted best accessories and most likely to marry within her faith. So the comparison is obvious. Now, you know, the funny thing about that is that Paul Rudnick, under this pseudonym, is really getting at the falseness of the movie and showing how it's always trying to have its cake and eat it too. So it's a genuine form of film criticism, although it seems to be all satiric.
Andrea, sounds like you've got some other business to take care of as well.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate your time today.
Bye.
And I have to say, Philip Lopate, that one of the critics whom you omitted in this giant anthology is yourself.
Yes. I had to omit a lot of film critics I liked, including myself, because we ran out of pages. And it's a hefty book. It's a kind of a doorstopper. And at a certain point, you have to think about unit costs and paper costs and things like that. So I think the book is very true to the historical record. And when it gets to the contemporary moment, I couldn't put in a lot of film critics who I really love.
Hmm. Interestingly, you point out that the hardest era always to judge is the present.
Yes, exactly. We don't have enough distance from the present. And in the case of a practitioner such as myself, I know too many of these people.
and they might get back at you.
Well, I think I am going to have a few enemies out there, but I hope that they, in time, will forgive and understand that I did have space pressures and also be grateful, I hope, for the riches that are in the book rather than brooding too much about the film critics that were left out.
The book is American Movie Critics, an anthology from the silence until now. And Philip Lopate, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it was a great pleasure.
Philip Lopate joined us from our bureau in New York. When we come back, protests in France.